Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. According to recent reports, international adoptions have dropped 75% since reaching their peak 11 years ago. Back in 2004, Americans adopted 23,000 children from other countries. Last year, U.S. families adopted just over 5,600 children. This hour, we're going to look at why those numbers are dropping and why some countries have banned international adoption outright. We'd also like to hear from you. If you were adopted from outside the U.S., what has your experience been? And if you adopted a child from another country, we'd like to hear your story, too. You can join us at 651-227-6000, that's 651-227-6000, or call toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. You can also join us online at nprnews.org/live, submit your comment or question there. Joining me this hour is Susan Kaufman, president and CEO of New Hope Media, which publishes Adoptive Families magazine. We're also joined by writer and Korean adoptee Steve Harouche. Steve has written for the New York Times and for NPR's Code Switch. And adult adoptee and adoption scholar Liz Raleigh. She teaches at Carleton College and has a book on adoption coming out titled Selling Transracial Adoption, Families, Markets, and the Color Line. Thanks to all of you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
Great. It's nice to be here.
Our pleasure.
First to you, Susan Kaufman. Why is international adoption on the decline?
Regulations have changed. Well, a couple of reasons. The two countries, the big uptick in international adoption really primarily came from China and Russia, and both of those countries have many fewer international adoptions now for different reasons. In China, there just are no longer available children as there were during the peak of the one-child policy. And as China has developed more, the adoption that takes place tends to be within the country, which I think everyone applauds. Russia has changed its policies based on a number of scandals and attempts to stop an unregulated, I would say, adoption market. And that's also been true in other countries around the world. So I think most people believe that changes in international adoptions reflect a good response to some of the things that were happening that were unregulated during the peak of international adoption. That's certainly true in Ethiopia, in Guatemala, and to some degree in Russia. So that's kind of a general overview.
Let's talk a little bit more in detail about what exactly was happening in these countries where adoption was highly unregulated.
Well, I think in countries like Guatemala and Russia, where there were individual facilitators working in adoption, there were no real regulations to protect both parents' rights, to protect the rights of children in orphanages. While many children who were placed for adoption did indeed legally require families, it's hard to know in other cases, especially in Guatemala, for example. The Hague Convention was passed, international treaty in 2008, which put in place protections and legal requirements for processes to make sure that international adoptions were taking place legally. I don't want to suggest by any means that, you know, most of the international adoptions that took place were in some way fraudulent. We don't know that that's the case, but the new measures that went into place put in place controls and safeguards with the goal of making sure that nothing took place that was not completely above board.
Right. But in some of those worst cases, which I think has been the inspiration for some of these countries shutting down international adoption entirely, have involved children that actually had families who were being told that they were being sent to school and that they would be sending money back to their families, that this was not an adoption, that this was some other sort of agreement.
I think that took place on occasion, certainly.
Yeah. The fact that certain countries like Guatemala and Haiti have banned international adoption outright, what do you think of that?
I mean, I think that unless they can put in place a good process to manage international adoption, that's the best solution. The result is that there are children without question who are indeed in need of families who won't find them, but the alternative is not a good one. So,
Okay, thank you. Liz Raleigh, you write about the adoption industry. In your research, have you found people's experiences of international adoption to be predominantly positive, negative? What are you finding?
So my work, most of it is, I don't particularly specifically look at adoptive parents, but I look at those who are involved in sort of putting the adoptive family together. So I spent a couple of years sort of attending information sessions and interviewing adoption social workers mostly. And I want to stress that many of these, and they're mostly women, you know, are really drawn because they want to do sort of the child welfare aspect of the work. And yet private adoption, and specifically international adoption, is a little bit different because even though the child is supposed to be the client, everything is supposed to be in the best interest of the client, especially in this declining marketplace that you talk about in the beginning, you know, how adoptions from 2004 to 2015 have declined drastically, that they're really struggling to try to stay afloat. And so all of these business decisions start to come into it. You know, I spoke to one woman who's worked in adoption for several years, and in terms of the lack of supply, she said, you know, we need babies to make money. It's a horrible way to look at it, but that's how you keep your doors open in international adoption. And so one of the things that they've been trying to do is to adjust. As the child population has changed and there's been more older children and children with special needs, the parents are oftentimes going elsewhere. Understandably, for private adoption, they're either looking domestically or maybe thinking about foster care. But I think adoption numbers have dropped in general, and so more of these prospective parents are either going to surrogacy, assisted reproductive technology, or thinking about being child-free.
So do you think, in part, that's because they're looking at the international adoption market and realizing just how complex and fraught with problems it is?
Necessarily when people go in, and then again, I'm quoting and kind of paraphrasing from the women I interviewed who work with clients all the time, is that they're going in oftentimes looking for a baby. And then understandably, if you wanted a child via biological reproduction, they want what other parents get, a same race newborn who they don't have to share in terms of thinking about open adoption agreements. It's interesting, what you talked about, you know, callers that you want to hear from in terms of international adoption. You said, you know, are there parents out there? Are there adult adoptees? Of course, the last person and the member of the triad that's very absent in international adoption are the birth parents, first parents themselves who do the placing.
Right.
But yet, one of the big allures of international adoption used to be that these adoptions were largely closed. Of course, later on, as adult adoptees have grown up, they've come to open them and sometimes find things that are flat out fraudulent in their files. But in general, many people who go back and look can't find anything. And I think when parents are just starting out trying to figure out if they want to form a family through adoption, even if adoption, and specifically if it wasn't their first choice, that's an allure. Later on, many parents, as their children get older, change their mind and understand the value of having an open relationship. But of course, international adoption, with maybe the exception of Ethiopia, is not really set up that way.
So what you're saying is actually that some of these families were seeking out a foreign adoption because that would ensure that there wasn't that parental family interaction with, say, the parents who gave up the child for adoption?
So I think it's a complex thing, and I'm not trying to say that parents are coldly rational. Again, you know, they start out wanting, you know, I have a little girl, what other people get, including myself, you know, a newborn that I can claim from gestation onward. And parents who, especially those who've gone through infertility, and there's lots of studies that say adoptive parents are 10 times more likely to have had a background with fertility or fertility barriers, that they want to have that. And so the idea, especially of a birth parent who has, now that first mothers, birth mothers are more empowered and they can actually write things like pre-adoption contact agreements, that can be scary. And so at the time when blockbuster countries like Guatemala and China, when they were known for placing thousands of children, about 90% of them under age 1 or 2, it was a very attractive way in order to form a family. Of course, now when you have, 5,600 children a year and only like 29% of them are under two at the time of placement, it's not as attractive anymore. And that's part of the reasons the numbers have dropped.
We're talking this hour about international adoption and its complexities, why the market for international adoption has dropped markedly over the past decade. You can call us with your question or comment, your experience with adoption at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Steve Harush, you've written extensively about international adoption, particularly Korean-American adoptees, and your experience as an adoptee. You know, in the 1980s, thousands of Korean children were adopted overseas each year. Last year, that number was down to 318 foreign adoptions. How do you feel about seeing those numbers dropping so markedly?
You know, it's one of those where I think my feelings are mixed. You know, I think a lot of people, Korean adoptees that I've talked to, you know, there's a certain sense of loss for having, you know, sort of grown up isolated and sort of having to sort of recover your Korean identity on your own. At the same time, you know, talking to people who are advocates for domestic adoption in Korea, we know that those domestic adoption numbers, while they've improved, are still not great. And so on the one hand, you know, the opportunity for kids to possibly stay in Korea and find a family there is great. But there's part of me that also feels for the kids who are sort of caught in between now, where the attitudes in the country toward adoption have not necessarily caught up with the policy. Mm-hmm. So that's a real thing.
How are cultural attitudes hindering progress? What is it that is preventing more domestic adoptions?
Well, family lineage is still an important idea in Korea. I mean, obviously the culture is evolving and people's feelings on this are evolving, but you know, the sense that you are tied to your family by blood is very powerful, and your connection to your family by blood is a very powerful notion. So the idea that you can just adopt a child from another bloodline, I hate to talk about it in those terms, but you know, mm-hmm. to for that child to become part of your bloodline when they are not biologically part of that bloodline, that is a very difficult barrier for a lot of Koreans to cross. So just because it's so built into the culture that your family and your ties there are so important.
You mentioned earlier that South Korea has actually reformed some of its policies around adoption. My understanding is that that's actually the result of activism by Korean international adoptees. Am I right? That they've been involved?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so how exactly have they changed policy?
Well, in 2012, this thing called the Special Adoption Law was enacted, and that was very much lobbied for by groups that were led by Korean adoptees who had gone back to Korea and had gone there or stayed there really with the intention of trying to reform the adoption system there.
Hmm. We're taking callers this hour and listening to their experience about adoption. If you've been an adoptive parent or were adopted, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rick on the line in Minneapolis. Rick, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We, my wife and I adopted a girl from Guatemala about 11 years ago, when all this started to decline. And I just wanted to, it's difficult for me to make this short, but I'm going to try.
Okay.
We were instrumental in closing down an adoption agency called Reaching Arms International that began, our daughter was the last successful adoption out of that agency. I don't know if you've mentioned it yet, but how it worked is you gave them money up front and then they went looking for kids, right?
Oh.
Well, that money up front was significant. And they started taking the money and sending the people after us fake pictures. Just whatever little kid they had laying around, they'd send them a picture. Without even any attempt to make to make the pictures look that, like the same kid, you know? And then they tell you that, oh, there's so many regulations and stuff, and the paperwork is held up, and, you know, one excuse after the other, and basically just ripped off people. But what I'm trying to get around to is I was astounded at how little regulation there was on the American side of it. I mean, there is no real overarching government of adoption agencies in this country. They could do whatever they dang well wanted to, and they did. And I wonder if that's changed, or, you know, we Norm Coleman was looking into this at the time because he promoted himself as a big adoption proponent. To no avail, zero. That was a total waste of time for us.
So did you have concerns that your child might not have actually been an orphan?
You know, you can't say for sure, right? Our foster mom was wonderful. The woman that was helping her was wonderful. She was in a private foster care instead of a group living situation. So I think that made it better. But you can't ever get rid of the doubt. I mean, I'm 95% sure, but who can say?
That must be really hard as an adoptive parent to live with that.
It is.
Rick, thank you for your call. Really appreciate it. Susan Kaufman, what do we know about the latest in terms of national regulation on the American side of international adoption?
I don't know. There was an attempt some years ago to pass a national adoption law to manage and govern adoption across in the entire United States, which would be by far the best way to manage control, you know, regulate adoption agencies, but I don't think that it had a chance of passing. And as far as I know, that initiative is not ongoing. So at this point, adoption agency regulation takes place at the state level, and as such varies dramatically.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Barbara on the line in Eagan. Barbara, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thanks.
Great. So I am a Korean adoptee, and I'm in my 30s. So this is, of course, a topic close to my heart.
Right.
And it's something that both my husband and I, we've always felt that we wanted to do as we started a family. And we actually pursued international adoption. And the first reason we did that is because I don't agree with American adoption law. All the rights reside with the birth parents. And even as you we're speaking of the in private adoption, how, you know, birth parents can see the children, I don't feel like there's any research to say whether that's harmless or harmful. But I feel that all the rights always reside with the birth parents. So if a child, 3 years down the road, and there could be a custody battle between the birth parents and the adoption parents, and the birth parents always win in America. So that was why we ruled out.
Could I jump in when there's a chance? I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut you off, Barbara, but I did feel I wanted to just sort of maybe add a different voice to that in terms of what I know about, you know, relinquishing custody is that certainly different states, and as Susan mentioned, it's very different across all 50 states, but there are different laws in terms of how long a birth mother, first mother has to relinquish, but then at a certain point it becomes irrevocable. And so in some states, once they sign, you know, they can sign 3 days after birth, and then occasionally there are these 30-day, but nothing like 3 years, certainly.
Right, but see,
go ahead, Barbara.
What if the birth parent says that, it doesn't put the birth father on the birth certificate, and all of a sudden the birth father decides to show up 3 years later. The birth father has their rights trump the adoptive parents. And it's never about the welfare of the child. It's always about the birth parents.
Well, I would counter that having an open relationship is about the welfare of the child. And then I know that there's a lot of, and you and I as adult adoptees at some other point could probably have a longer conversation about this. But as somebody whose job it is right now to kind of talk about sort of the larger discourse of research, you know, there is an emerging research that's going on in terms of thinking about how to balance open adoptive relationships and what they can give. And the reason that there's not a great amount is that there hasn't been a lot of time yet.
Liz, I'd like to let Barbara get to the end of her experience before we start the critique, but thank you. I appreciate it.
Back to that comment, though. I did meet my birth mother when I, about not quite 10 years ago, and I was like 28 years old, I think. And it was a very emotional experience. And as a 28-year-old, I would just like to say that that was a very, just a very emotional experience that I personally don't think that a small child can necessarily handle. And I just say we don't know the results. We don't know whether it's harmful or harmless. And I'm not saying it is harmful. I'm just saying we don't know yet. And I feel like we've just gone the route of the birth parents get to decide everything. So, but
wait, you did not end up doing international adoption, then tell us why.
Right. So the reason we didn't move forward with international adoption is two main reasons. We were told, so we actually contacted the adoption agency, started the process, and we found out it was going to cost a minimum of $30,000. That was a minimum from any country, as we were open to any country. Mm-hmm. The second reason is because we were told that we wouldn't be able to get a child under the age of three, mm-hmm. and even under the age of three with no guarantee. So it just, for us who, you know, we fortunately have the ability to have biological children. We decided, one, that money needs to go to our current child's college education. And number two is I don't know that I'm equipped to handle a child that shows up when they're 3+ years old and all the, you know, issues and emotional, you know, concerns that you have for a child that doesn't speak the language and has been living elsewhere, you know, and you don't know necessarily what their background is.
All right, Barbara, thanks so much for sharing your story. I appreciate that. Liz Raleigh, what do you think? These are common issues in the market of adoption, aren't they? The desire to have a child who's young, that you can impress upon them your values, your love, your stories, as opposed to them coming with you with maybe childhood trauma you don't know about.
Well, I mean, I think that Barbara raises a really good point, that a lot of people start looking at international adoption nowadays and decide that they're either going to, you know, they're going to pursue some other form of family building. And the numbers in Korea, they are way down. I was just looking, you know, in 2015, there were 318 children that were placed. And that's one of the last places that actually does have a reasonable sort of supply, if you will, of younger babies. And so for those, and when we think about this idea of, and I just want to circle back to this sense of an orphan, I want just to reiterate to listeners that in international adoption in particular, orphan does not mean that both the parents are dead. They have been classified by the U.S. Department of State as social orphans, usually legal orphans. And so oftentimes the parents are there. They can be found later on. And so because there are so few children who are being placed, the waits are really, really long. And so in Korea, the waits can be, you know, a couple of years. At China's peak, you know, they were quoting 6-8 years until they just stopped taking applications for a healthy baby about 1 year old.
So I find that a fascinating point that I think UNICEF as well, United Nations, they label an orphan as defined not necessarily as a child with no parents. It could be a child with one parent or, a child that is simply in a state of, you know, or under stress in terms of their environment. And then they say, oh, it would be better if we could put them in a different situation. Doesn't that sort of color the I mean, Susan Kaufman, do you think parents, potential adoptive parents, get a little less eager to adopt when they find out that, oh, there are still living parents here who are...
I think the majority of children adopted internationally or in the U.S. for that matter have living biological parents, and that is something that adoptive parents have to understand and reconcile themselves to. I don't think, I think it's clear that that's the case, yeah. So these are not orphans as in neither biological parents alive. I mean, personally, I think that
that many more people would adopt internationally if they could, despite the older children and the rest of it. I think that, as Liz said, many people have given up their hope of adoption and are moving on now. We certainly see this to surrogacy, to assisted reproductive technologies, or to child-free living. And I think that there's actually tremendous desire to adopt in the U.S. and throughout in Europe as well. It's not met, but that's what it is.
Now, Susan Kaufman, I understand that there is now a new job category, which is adoption researchers, people who are employed to sort of double check and make sure that the story that they've been given by the adoption agency is a true story about their child. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I don't know about that. Is that something that's a State Department mandated?
No, I this is actually...
I know that in the process of granting a visa, there is research done on whether, in fact, the child was legally relinquished, but I don't know about the category of adoption researcher.
This is something I read about in The Atlantic, that these are privately hired individuals who track down, they go to sort of the orphanage and try and find out more information, go to the village, present photos, and they actually interview the parents and just verify that their child was put up for adoption willingly and that this wasn't a case.
This is after adoption rather than before?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. No, we certainly have had stories from an Adopted Families magazine from a number of parents who became concerned that perhaps their child had been illegally adopted and indeed hired people to, I think very courageously, to track down the village to find out the story because they felt that they couldn't live with not knowing the truth. So, yeah, we've certainly heard of that. There are also searchers who were hired internationally now to help parents, to help children find their birth family. It's very controversial as to whether adopted parents should be involved in that. Many people believe, I think, certainly I do, that that's a decision that the child has to, an adoptee has to make on his or her own behalf as to whether they choose to search or not. But it is certainly being done in China, in Russia, in other countries where adopted parents are involved in searching for their children's birth family after the fact. And I think, as Liz mentioned, many people may consider the fact that there won't be a trace of their child's birth family as a positive before they adopt. But almost immediately, we find after they adopt, they become oftentimes almost obsessed with finding their children's birth family, you know, to tell them their child's healthy, to find out more about them. There is a sort of a real interest in finding birth family that takes place, at least in our community, that as we hear from our readers. And I do think that open adoption is becoming increasingly understood to be a positive for children.
Thanks. So I'd like to go to Steve Harush now. Steve Harush, yep. You've been sitting patiently by the sidelines here, and I want to hear a little bit more about your personal experience and what you think of international adoption, even if everything goes swimmingly. And that the adoption is all above board. What are the lasting consequences of being raised in a family of an entirely different culture than the one that you are genetically from? What has been your experience, and what have you seen in peers who have gone through the experience of being adoptees here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I would preface that by saying, you know, my childhood was very good. My relationship with my family is great. I am so lucky for everything that I've been able to have, the life that I had. And what I would add, though, is that in addition to that, you know, there is something that happens, and this is a sense that I have gotten from talking to Korean adoptees, for which I've been doing for many years. We all have this very common experience, which is almost identical, where we reach this point where we desire this connection to this place that we were taken from, or that we left, most of us too young to make that decision at all. And, you know, it's not that you can't build a great family with adoptive parents and adopted kids. I don't know anyone who's arguing against that. But there is a real sense, especially, and I think most of the people that I've talked to, this was the case. We grew up where there was no one like us around. So when you reach that age in adolescence where people really start to emphasize the differences between people, not only are you alone in that, but not even your family can really understand what you're going through. Mm. So that is something that, you know, may just be unavoidable. I mean, the cruelties of childhood are spare no one. So adoptees are not special in that regard. But I think that sometimes, and I definitely think this has improved a lot over the past decade or so, that parents just aren't equipped for that. They don't see it coming. My parents really were not prepared for that. They didn't know how to talk to me about it.
Interesting. Steve, thanks so much for that. We are talking this hour about international adoption. We'd love to hear from you. We've got a full bank of phone lines that we will get to in just a moment. But first, it's time for a checkup of news with Phil Picardi in the NPR Newsroom. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Marianne. Florida Governor Rick Scott is ordering state government offices in 51 counties to close, with Tropical Storm Hermine threatening Florida's Gulf Coast. The order includes the state capital, Tallahassee, which could get its first direct hit by a hurricane in 30 years. Forecasters are expecting the storm to become a hurricane before it moves ashore later tonight or early tomorrow. Residents of some low-lying areas are being urged to evacuate. SpaceX says a massive explosion has destroyed one of its rockets during a routine test for a planned weekend launch at Cape Canaveral. An Israeli satellite aboard the rocket was also destroyed. The company was conducting a test firing of its unmanned Falcon rocket when the blast occurred. A grand jury in Alabama has indicted a former space shuttle commander in a traffic crash that killed two girls and injured two adults. A prosecutor says James Halsell was indicted on charges of reckless murder and assault in a June wreck. The girls' relatives filed lawsuits blaming the former astronaut for the deaths. Halsell's attorneys have filed a document saying the driver of the other car failed to yield and contributed to that wreck. The Chicago Police Department says the city recorded 90 homicides in August, its highest monthly death toll in 20 years. Police say there were 384 shooting incidents and 472 shooting victims during the month. The department says five districts on the city's south and west sides account for the majority of the violence in Chicago. Today is day two of President Obama's environmental conservation trip. He is traveling to Midway Atoll, one of the most remote corners of the ocean. It's the area where Obama has expanded a marine national monument to more than 580,000 square miles. Obama's decision to expand the monument was the subject of fierce debate in Hawaii, with both sides invoking native Hawaiian culture to argue why it should or should not be expanded. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:38.
We should learn today how much the federal government is proposing to raise premium rates in Minnesota's individual health insurance market. I'm Kathy Werzer. Listen for that story, meteorologist Mark Seely, and all the latest news tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Stay tuned at 11. NPR News with Tom Weber is live at the Minnesota State Fair. Tom talks politics with two former state lawmakers. He's at the NPR booth with former DFL Speaker of the House, Margaret Anderson Kelleher, and former Republican Senate Majority Leader, Amy Koch. That's coming up next at 11.
Programming is supported by Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux Community, which donates millions of dollars each year to provide scholarships, protect the environment, and improve health and safety in Minnesota communities. Learn more at ShakopeeDakota.org.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs in this morning for Carrie Miller, and we're talking about international adoption. According to recent reports, international adoptions have dropped 75% since reaching their peak back in 2004. Joining me this hour is Susan Kaufman, president and CEO of New Hope Media, which publishes Adoptive Families magazine. We're also joined by writer and Korean adoptee Steve Harouche and adult adoptee and adoption scholar Liz Raleigh. She teaches at Carleton College. Let's get right to the phones. We've got Jen on the line in Stillwater. Jen, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks for checking.
So I have two children who are adopted from Guatemala. I also have a sister who was adopted from Korea, as well as a cousin.
Wow.
And So lots of international adoption in our family, of which we're all very proud, and I think of which all of those children are smart, successful, happy children. I feel like I just need to stand up for the fact that that there was no fraud. I don't think. I guess I don't know about the Korean adoption, but both of my children from Guatemala have the same birth mother. We met her. She made a plan in the same way that lots of mothers in the United States make the adoption plans when they're not capable or able to care for their children in the way that they would like to do so. And I think that it's just a shame that those a lot of those mothers now in Guatemala don't have that option to make a plan to provide a different life for their children than what they might otherwise do so. There's tons of discrimination in Guatemala against the Mayan children. My children are both Mayan. So again, I feel like with UNICEF and the things that people have done to cut off the ability for some of those children to find a different life, it's sad.
Hmm. Jen, thank you for that comment. Susan Kaufman, what do you think that, how does this change the situation for so many children who are in these countries who no longer have the option of adoption in the United States or elsewhere?
You know, I think it's tragic. I think everyone would agree to that. There are some 600,000 children in institutions in the Soviet Union, and we simply do not have a regulatory environment or a system whereby those children who really are truly available for adoption and need families can find them. It's sad for both the families who like to adopt and for the children.
Liz Raleigh, what do you think?
Well, in terms of Guatemala in general, I mean, it's a hard thing. And I think that's where international adoption and why the phones are so lit up is that even though it's a relatively small portion of the child population, it really speaks to people on a personal level. I want to just kind of talk a little structurally, though, about Guatemala, that at the height of the adoption boom, you know, 1 out of 100 live births from Guatemala was estimated to go north to be adopted internationally. And so certainly, you know, there you could say that there are birth mothers there who don't have that option anymore. But at the same time, that has to be coupled with a lot of pretty substantiated reports. And of course, this is not all. And adoption's messy. Anything with family is messy. You can't make sweeping allegations. But I think it's important to balance those sort of stories that people want to understandably advocate for their families with stories that often aren't really told. You could read Finding Fernanda, which is a great book to talk a little bit about one particular family, and then the caller, Rick, of course, who came forward. I think the policy, and that's why we haven't seen a lot of change, is that it's messy because you have a lot of people who understandably want to advocate for their children, and they see this as a way of doing so.
You know, Krista, who writes online, says, even though my life as a biracial child in Korea could have been horrible, I've been robbed of my true identity. My adoptive parents did very little in helping me to embrace my nationalities and focused more on whitewashing me. For this experience like Krista's, and I think, Steve, what maybe we're getting at here in part of the complexity is that this involves a very significant choice about a person who at that time has no say in that choice because they're a baby, that they have to live with the consequences for better or for worse of who they're adopted by and the adoptive life that they get. Steve, talk a little bit about how this plays out.
Yeah, you know, and there's certainly a range of experiences for adoptees. I know sometimes people are really discouraged from pursuing or even really thinking about any part of their previous identity, and whether that's racism, whether that's just fear on part of the adoptive parents that they won't fully be accepted as parents if their child has these longings or has this identity. There's a really a range of experiences that people have with that, and it can be very damaging to a person where you're asking them to sort of erase this part of themselves that they can see, that others can see, that they may be ridiculed for, and then to be told that, oh well, just pretend that it doesn't exist, and you're waking up in the morning knowing that you can't pretend that it doesn't exist because it does. So I think that, you know, and again, this is an area where I think there's been a lot of evolution. I think there's been a lot of really great work by adoptive parents to open themselves up to to talk to each other, to talk to adult adoptees to really sort of advance this conversation. But yes, it is something that you see, and it's very sad to hear people say that they've had this part of them really suppressed and really been discouraged from exploring it.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got James on the line in Minneapolis. James, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to thank Steve for his work and exposing the experiences that biracially adopted children have. I'm the father of a six-year-old boy from China that we brought home at 4 years old. And when we entered the process, I wouldn't have thought that that was a real issue. But if you work through in a reputable adoption agency, you're actually required to take classes on biracial parenting and explore what you will do to, you know, help your child navigate that as they, you know, move through childhood and adulthood, both their culture and both, you know, being different from their family. However, I just can't, you know, understate the beauty and joy that we've had in watching, you know, a malnourished kid that couldn't hear, you know, have a procedure done to fix his hearing and put on muscle mass and learn to ride a bike. And I'll never experience the challenges that he'll have. I mean, we're somewhere and he sees a kid with jet black hair, even if he's, you know, a Latin kid, he'll say, oh, maybe he's from China. So, I mean, it's just hardwired in there, you know, like Steve says. And I guess that's the extent of my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, James. I think, you know, James mentioned kids with special needs and the fact that some of these kids are coming with either, you know, physical disabilities or other disabilities. And what responsibility, you know, the fact that these kids can get treatment for these in some countries but can't elsewhere, how does that color the desire to, I mean, the responsibility of international adoption, the importance of international adoption? Susan Kaufman?
I think there's always been a small percentage of those who adopt who do so out of a desire to help a child who needs medical help. But in general, I think that most people adopt out of their own desire to have a family, and they're not motivated necessarily by a desire to help another child, nor is necessarily that. It can be a wonderful reason to adopt, but it can also be distortion of the sort of parent-child relationship. But without question, as international adoption has become more difficult, there are more children who could benefit from health care that are not reaching it or not able to get it.
I guess the question this brings up, and this may not even be an adoption question, but what to be done with the thousands upon thousands of children who are older or have physical disabilities or, you know, some sort of barrier to being the perfect adoptive child, but they are in orphanages in countries around the world. What can be done for them?
Well, in the adoption community, we do see a considerable, among the Chinese adoptive parents, for example, there are a number of foundations set up where parents donate and send funds back to support children who were not adopted, who were in orphanages. And I think this kind of child welfare activity is obviously something that people are motivated to do, knowing that their child was a lucky one to get the care that they needed and that there are kids left behind. So it's a responsibility that everyone, I think, shares.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Paula on the line in Minneapolis. Paula, welcome.
Hi, this is Paula.
Yes, what's your
comment?
Yeah, what's your comment or question?
Well, it's a sort of a comment, a historical comment. I adopted two children in 72 and 74. My first son is from Korea, my second one Vietnam. At the time, before we were approved for adoption, at that time, home studies were much more thorough and intense than they are now. We went through a weekend-long kind of retreat training thing where the whole focus of which was understanding the importance of having a positive cultural identity, racial identity, ethnic identity, whatever. We were really pushed to think about, is that something that we would commit to? And we had all kinds of information about you know, other people's experiences, children's experiences growing up in a home where the parents are a different race, different culture, and so on. It was not, it's much easier, and I know this because I have subsequently worked for a period of time as a social worker in adoptions. So something changed in the laws. I think it was U.S. law, but people no longer were pushed to consider whether or not they were prepared to do what they would need to do to help their child develop and maintain a positive identity.
Interesting, Paula. So now your kids are in their 40s.
They are. Oh, you had to say that, didn't you?
Sorry.
they are. That's true.
I only recognize, it's just because I recognize that their year of birth was close to mine. So I'm just curious, do you have conversations with them now about sort of the long-term legacy of the fact that they were adopted?
Absolutely. Yes. And we did throughout their lives. I think, and their experiences were quite different. My first child longed to know his biological mother, his birth mother. He just, he felt that there was a big piece of him that was missing. My second child, who's from Vietnam and was born toward the end of the war, had never had an interest in his culture, his identity. And when we would do things like go out to a Vietnamese restaurant for dinner, choosing what restaurant, I would say, well, do you want to go to Vietnamese? And my son, I guess he was about 14 at the time, said to me, sure, Mom, I'll do that, but it's for you.
Oh,
not for
me. Interesting.
We continued, fortunately, because his race and his identity became extremely important as he moved into adulthood and went away to college. So,
all right. Paula, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Liz Raleigh, in your research around adoption and the industry of adoption, Paula mentioned that, you know, it seems like things have gotten much easier over the years. Is that something you've seen in your research?
Well, I can certainly, I would say that probably policy-wise, that if they're adopting, you know, Susan mentioned the ratification of the Hague Convention, where they require 10 hours of adoptive training. So that seems pretty new. And again, that's only for countries who are adopting out of a Hague ratified country. So it doesn't apply to all international adoptions. So there is something now that requires a little bit of education. But the education can really, in 10 hours, you can imagine you could do child CPR, you could do, you know, creating a life book for your kid. And so actually spending, it's sort of parent-driven, those who want to spend a lot of time thinking about race and ethnicity beforehand. Unfortunately, my research, and especially because those who, quote, come to adoption, oftentimes because they want to find a young baby and they're not necessarily thinking down the road. You know, one, and I just want to share this one part, that I interviewed a social worker who talked about this and her concern, you know, one said that she didn't feel like she could turn down a family if they, even if she worried that they weren't going to be very, like, good at providing diversity and racial education for their kids. And another said, you know, do I think every one of the parents I work with totally get it and are going to be fabulous transracial families? No, I don't. And so those families, though, that could use a lot of support once the adoption goes through, sometimes drop out of the system. There's not a lot of post-adoption contact. And so that's where I think this connects well with what Steve was saying in terms of the experiences of adult adoptees who grow up in families who are trying. You know, they're going to soccer. They're doing all those things that they, you know, what their kids need, and of course they love their kids and they want what's best for them. But sometimes I think the breakdown is in the training for the parents, that they don't understand necessarily what the tools they need. And so, as someone else said, they don't know what they don't know. Hmm. And I think it's important to keep that in mind as international adoption goes forward.
Steve Harush, you want to add anything to that? I heard it sounded like you wanted to say something there, but maybe I didn't.
Well, I was just agreeing with that, and also, you know, I think that, you know, parents can evolve on that, and also I think a lot of times or sometimes anyway, I get the sense from when I talk to adoptive parents sometimes that there's a little defensiveness about it, and being a parent myself now, like I understand that, like, all the other stuff you have to do to take care of a child and shepherd them through life, like, that's a lot of stuff. And then to have this other layer on top of that where you may feel completely out of your depths, it's not something you've really thought about or studied, like, I get that, and I think adoptees get that. But, you know, I think it's hard because you don't always know when to start those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just encourage anyone who is a parent, an adoptive parent, you know, that just it's never too early to start just talking about these things openly, because especially if you're not accustomed to talking about race or ethnicity or any of those things, it's going to take some time to feel comfortable with it. So just being open in the same way that you're open about saying that your child is adopted or having a child who is not biologically yours, just practice that. It's a muscle that takes a lot of exercise.
All right. Thanks for that. Let's go to the phones. We've got Kevin on the line in Minneapolis. Kevin, what's your comment or question?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question to all of your guests is, what are your guest thoughts about the money in international adoption? Because there's literally thousands and thousands of dollars when the U.S. dollar could go so far in other countries for family preservation.
Interesting question. Thanks for that, Kevin. So, Liz Raleigh, what do you think? This is a huge industry. Let's talk about the money a little bit.
I mean, I think it's a really good question. And though I think what probably a lot of parents and what I found in my research is that, you know, they're not people who want to adopt, they want to add to their families. And then if it can be seen as a narrative of being good for the country, good for orphans, then that's beneficial in helping them to, you know, legitimize their choices, and especially the narrative in the U.S., which is really just, you know, pro-adoption, which is great in some ways, but it's also kind of unnuanced. I would say, though, you know, that a lot of times that people who are adopting, it's about the median cost is about $31,000, you know, half the cost of the median income in the U.S., that those parents don't necessarily want family preservation. They want a baby. And so it's not, oh, maybe I'll adopt or I'll put that money towards family preservation. It's maybe I'll adopt internationally or maybe I'll adopt domestically or hire a surrogate. We talked about all of those thousands of children in orphanages, you know, outside of the United States that need care. But I would also add that in the United States, there are 107,000 children waiting in U.S. foster care whose parental rights have been terminated and who are looking for adoptive families as well. And those adoptions are largely free, certainly with the tax credit, but most of them tend to be subsidized anyway by public dollars. And so even though I would love to see more money for family preservation, I'm sure it's not going to come from the wallets of adoptive parents who are looking to adopt.
All right. I'm sorry we're running out of time here. We've just got a little bit of time left. Susan Kaufman, any last thoughts on the future of international adoption and what needs to happen?
Oh, you know, I think international adoption may never be what it was 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that may be, you know, for the best in many ways. As development occurs in China, as you know, resources grow to help other families stay whole in other countries, that may be preferable to, in many ways, to what happened 20 years ago when there was this huge burst of international adoption. It wasn't an unusual situation. It's not likely to recur, I don't believe.
Okay. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us this hour for this conversation. It's been really fascinating and obviously quite complex. A special thanks to Susan Kaufman, President and CEO of New Hope Media, which publishes Adoptive Families magazine. We've been joined by Korean adoptee Steve Harouche. Steve writes for writes for NPR's Code Switch, which is known for it's a podcast about race. He's also written for the New York Times about his experience as a Korean-American adoptee. And we've talked with Liz Raleigh. She teaches at Carleton College and has a book on adoption coming out titled Selling Transracial Adoption: Families, Markets, and the Color Line.